listening to The Nature Between Us. My name is Tessa and I'm your host. This podcast is produced on the land of the Bidjigal and Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. I acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land and pay my respects to elders past, present, and future. This episode is all about one of my favourite things, seaweed. It not only looks incredible, but it provides habitat, a food source, a carbon sink, it acts as an ocean regulator, and it has many, many other cool attributes. And in Australia, we've got a lot of seaweed, especially in the cool water ecosystems on the Great Southern Reef. What's that, you ask? Well, today's guest and marine ecologist Dr. Sarah Bell is the perfect person to ask. A self-confessed kelp forest enthusiast, she currently works on the Great Southern Reef Project. She led the original designation of the Great Southern Reef as a Mission Blue Hope Spot in 2019 and now works alongside filmmakers and scientists on projects to drive local stewardship of the region. She's also a marine ecologist at the University of Western Australia's Ocean Institute, and her mantra, "People protect what they love and love what they understand," is the driving force behind all her projects. We get chatting about the Great Southern Reef, obviously, why it's so important to protect, how the kelp forests are faring, and of course, what we can do to help. Enjoy! So my first question was, when did you first become interested in kelp forests?
I mean, as a kid, I wanted to be a marine biologist like every other person does. And then I kind of just followed that through high school studying biology and chem and really fell into it at uni. I went into uni not super passionate about anything in particular, but kind of liked the environment. I liked being out in the environment, but I didn't really know how to kind of marry up those two. How can I contribute to something that I enjoy at the moment? And it wasn't really until the last year of my university degree where I had this amazing professor, and he actually worked in seagrasses, so not seaweeds, slightly different. Oh. But he was a guru, an absolute guru, and it was what was needed to kind of flick that switch in my mind where I realized that there is this part of marine science that is not what everyone immediately thinks of when you tell them you're a marine biologist, but it's this plant science that is not only super important in Australia itself, but it's actually as under just as much threat as our tropical coral environments, if not more, and very much worth our protection. So it really took that inspiring professor to flick the switch for me. And then that drew me into completing my honours research with him. And so it was on seagrasses, similar but not. And then it wasn't until I decided to do my PhD research with another inspiring professor, which is when I flicked over to kelp forests. So for me, it wasn't really about being super focused on my study organism. It was more about being focused on what are the interesting questions and the really solid science that I can do as part of my research. Where can I contribute the most to? And then at that time, it was the kelp forests and the seagrass meadows, which is, yeah, what I decided to follow. And I think that's it's pretty important for lots of people or lots of aspiring marine biologists or enviros that I hear heaps of people coming in and say, oh, I want to work on whales. Who should I talk to? And it's so hard to have that train of thought in the industry these days, because it's not necessarily about the organism solely that you want to study. Of course, you've got to be passionate about what you're researching, but there are so many questions out there. And for me, it was really where can I contribute? Where can my work have a really significant impact? And that was the kelp forests and the temperate reefs for me.
Yeah, wow. Oh, well, that's awesome that you came across those inspiring professors. I love that. So you mentioned just then that first you did your honours thesis on seagrass. Mm-hmm. And so now I'm even more a bit befuddled because there's seagrass, there's kelp, mm-hmm. and there's seaweed.
Yeah.
Kind of help the listeners and me like distinguish between what is kelp and what is, how does everything fit together?
Yeah, so seagrasses are our true marine plants. So if you're out snorkeling and you're snorkeling over sand and you see something green and fluffy, that's probably a seagrass. So what makes them a true plant is that they have roots and they flower. So they're just like a plant on land, just like a tree, but they're in the ocean. Whereas seaweeds, they are an algae. So they still photosynthesize. So they take, they get their energy from the sun. So they produce their own energy like plants do, but they're not a true plant. So they don't have roots. They don't flower. And instead they have, they connect to rocky reefs. So if you're swimming over like some big limestone boulders or anything rocky and you see something green and fluffy, that's probably a seaweed. And that's the difference there, really, that substrate, what they're growing on or in is the really is how you tell whether it's a seagrass or a seaweed. And then kelp forests or kelp, a kelp is the descriptive name that we give to certain kinds of seaweeds. So kelps are our large habitat-forming seaweeds. So you could say all kelps are a seaweed, but not all seaweed are kelp. Kind of thing.
That's such a marine biologist riddle.
I know, isn't it? Well, I was trying to think of a better way to explain it, and I was thinking, imagine if you're talking about dogs to someone, you could say that all retrievers are a kind of dog, but not all dogs are retrievers. Like, and you have
okay. I love using dogs as analogies.
Yeah, retrievers are just this descriptive group, and even in there, you have golden retrievers, or you have your like all these different species or different kinds of retrievers, but they're in that descriptive group. So it's right. A descriptive name that's not used for one species or one organism. It's just kind of a group that we clump them all in to describe quite a few species. So in Australia, our main kelp is called Eclonia radiata or golden kelp. And this is the guy that we have found across literally the southern half of the country. If you drew a line straight across Australia and looked down, you would pretty much find golden kelp if you went for a swim, which is pretty unique. It's pretty cool that it's found across that massive stretch of coast.
Yeah, wow. And so the sea grass, if it's got its roots in the sand, is that where it gets its nutrients from, as if like a plant on land gets it from the soil?
Similar, yeah, it does. It's mostly the roots are kind of used for those microbial interactions that are, but yes, you could simplify it and to say that's how it gets its nutrients. Yeah.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. And so what characterizes a kelp forest? Does that mean there's lots of different types of species of kelp that make up a forest, like a forest on land?
Kind of. We started to use the term forest because we think that the habitats provided by kelp is more like a forest than anything else we could use to describe it. So it doesn't necessarily mean lots of species. In fact, most of the time across most of the coast, if you go down, you're going to see golden kelp as the only kelp species there. It's not until you go to places like Tassie or sometimes in Victoria where you get a few other species. It's 95% of the time it's golden kelp. But that's not the only species of seaweed there for sure. Okay. Seaweeds in temperate or cool water Australia, we have some of the most diverse seaweeds and endemic seaweeds. So these are seaweeds found only here and nowhere else across the globe. And that's something really unique about the Great Southern Reef and about our cool water systems here in Australia is this. Biodiversity is absolutely insane for our seaweeds. Like, we trump most of the rest of the world. If you're just looking at seaweeds, it's pretty epic. But yeah, we started calling them kelp forests because we wanted people to associate with them more like that. And it really is. Sometimes if you go for a dive, it's not like you're just looking down and you see this really low-lying, structurally not complex system. It really is like immersive. And you really can have these big boulders of kelp of these forests around you and then the fish all swimming around you. And we wanted to make it we wanted people to associate it with more like a forest habitat rather than just slimy seaweeds that people kind of sometimes have those negative associations with. So yeah, that's kind of why we use forest. We think it's the best descriptor.
I think that's a great, it's a great use of language to link it to something that already makes sense to people on land, exactly. Something that they experience a lot. It's clever. Yeah. Maybe I should ask you, we should talk about the Great Southern Reef before we get into how things are impacting the kelp forest, because it kind of feels like most of your research is focused on this Great Southern Reef, which is something that I didn't actually know much about, but you are a huge advocate for. So, maybe we can start with what is the Great Southern Reef, where is it, and why are you so excited about it?
So you are amongst many people who have never heard of the Great Southern Reef, and even scientists didn't know it existed until not even that long ago, like less than a decade. Scientists named it as an entity, as a thing that we know exists. And basically, along the southern half of the country is our cool water ecosystems, and we call these temperate ecosystems. And through a heap of scientific studies, we started to realize that all of these temperate ecosystems across the southern half of the country were super connected. They're really similar, super high biodiversity, super high rates of endemism, so rates of species that we find only here and nowhere else in the world. And we started to kind of look at all these different places and think, these are so similar and so connected. Could this be one interconnected system? So just like the Great Barrier Reef isn't one single reef, it's not one place, it's a series of connected reefs all along a stretch of coast, the Great Southern Reef is exactly the same, but for our temperate ecosystems. And this goes from about Kalbarri in the west coast, so about midway up, all the way south, all the way along the southern coast around Tassie, up the east coast into northern New South Wales. This whole system is all connected, super connected. And so scientists called this the Great Southern Reef. It's, still pretty new, relatively new, in saying that Indigenous communities have known about this system for forever. They've lived off this system, they've cared for this system, and it's only us scientists kind of catching up to realise just how epic it is and how worthy of protection that it is. So that's really what we're trying to do at the moment, is trying to help other people understand just how epic and just how worthy of protection it is.
And part of that was in 2019, you led the charge to have it listed as a Mission Blue Hope Spot. What does that mean, and what do you hope that that will achieve?
Yeah, so Mission Blue is run by the legendary Dr. Sylvia Earle, and their Hope Spot program is all about trying to recognize places around the globe that are super under-acknowledged but critical to ocean health. And the Great Southern Reef just fit that criteria perfectly. Nobody knows about it, but so much of the Australian economy relies on the Great Southern Reef, and without really realizing it, Australia, the community relies on it as well. And so it wasn't just me. I had an epic team supporting me in it, but we decided to nominate it as a Hope Spot, and kind of with that goal to just increase awareness, to raise the public profile of the Great Southern Reef. And we thought that the reach and the power that Mission Blue could bring to the table could be super impactful.
Awesome. And you said that the Great Southern Reef is really important for our ocean health, but then also our kind of economic stability and our social, like people don't realize how it is impacting them. Are you able to kind of flesh out some more specifics on those examples? Yeah.
In terms of the economy, you could just look at two of our most valuable fisheries. Those are our lobster and our abalone. And those are both temperate or cool water species that rely on a healthy Great Southern Reef, essentially. So both lobsters and abalone, they rely on that beautiful seaweed forest surrounding them for their food, for protection, for shelter, essentially. And without that, we don't have those stocks and we don't have those two major fisheries contributing to our economy. And we're super reliant on those. Many people don't really realise just how reliant. And those are the kind of, that's more of a direct effect or direct use of the Great Southern Reef by these organisms. But there are lots of kind of indirect ones as well, whether that's tourism or nutrient cycling or carbon storage. So that's kind of the big one that's going to be super relevant moving forward. These seaweeds, these kelp forests, they store a lot of carbon in their biomass, and carbon is obviously this element of climate change that we're trying to extract out of the environment. And just like trees on land, our kelp forests are doing exactly that as well. They're extracting carbon out of the environment, and their role in the long-term carbon storage and potential sequestration, we don't know too much about it. It's not like trees in that sense. We don't have a real solid idea of what happens to that carbon in the long term, but the potential for those guys to be a sink of carbon and to extract more carbon out of the atmosphere moving forward is really huge. It's pretty exciting stuff, to be honest.
Yeah. And what do you mean by nutrient cycling?
So they improve water quality, basically. So they like to take certain nutrients out of the water. They use it to grow to promote their growth. And sometimes the kelps.
The kelps, okay.
I do that too much. I talk about kelps and fish as like people. I'm like, yeah, they live here. They do this. I do that too much. I need to stop.
No, it's fine.
The kelp forest.
The kelp forest, yeah.
The kelp forest, yeah. Yeah, so there's been some studies, particularly on the south coast around in South Australia, where particularly poor water quality has been improved by kelp forests.
Right, wow.
Yeah.
Okay, so obviously making sure these kelp forests are healthy is really important, but there's a lot of impacts that are currently being, a lot of pressures that are being put on our kelp forests, which is what your PhD study is all about. What are these threats and impacts to our kelp forests?
Yeah, the big one is that all too familiar climate change.
Yeah,
no surprises there, but it's climate change is basically, it's changing the ecosystem at such a fast rate that it's becoming really hard for our kelp forests and for our temperate reefs to keep up with. So something that's really cool about kelps and even about seaweeds in general is that they are quite adaptive. They have this natural ability to adapt to change in their environment. So it's what makes them it's why we see them in such beautiful forests and in such high numbers across the reef, because they can adapt to that bit of natural variability. But the thing about climate change is that it's adding extra changes on top of this natural variability that's making it too extreme for our seaweeds and our kelp forests to adapt to. So I have this analogy that I like to use about describing the difference between natural variability and climate change. And imagine that you have this dice, and every time you roll that dice and you get a different number, this is like representing natural variability in an ecosystem. But climate change is like if you took a marker and you added one extra dot to every side of that dice. So now every time you roll it, even though the number only goes up by one, your lowest value doubles, your average increases by a third, and then your highest value goes up by 15%. Mm-hmm. So even though it's just that one extra dot, these extras, they manifest into something that's really significant over time. And those extras are what climate change is bringing to the table and is what our seaweed forests and kelps are not able to deal with.
Mm.
And for Australia, unfortunately, we are in a ocean warming hotspot. So that means our rate of warming is in the top 10% across the globe. So it's getting warm really quick here. And then even within Australia, there are kind of two sections which are warming the fastest, and that's our east and west coasts. And so there's obviously this gradual ocean warming, which is an increasing stress that the kelp forests need to deal with. But then we also have these extreme events, which is like our marine heat waves, which is another thing that our kelp forests need to deal with. And this is what my research, my PhD research has been looking at, is the long-term impacts of a marine heat wave that we had back in 2011 on the west coast of Australia. So that's a decade ago, and the temperatures are back to normal. Those impacts are gone. But in many of our regions where we lost kelps because of the marine heat wave, we're seeing absolutely no recovery. And so that was what my research was trying to look at, is why have they not come back?
Mm.
So we're seeing that these long-term impacts of what could be a heat wave that lasted for a month or two, the impacts are just dragging out, they're lingering on, and we're not seeing these systems recover, which is pretty devastating, and it's not the best news for our temperate reefs, considering that with climate change projections, we're expecting more frequent and more intense extreme events like what we had in 2011.
And when you talk about a marine heat wave, does that sit alongside a heat wave on land, or can that be happening independently without us on land knowing?
They happen independently, completely independently. Yeah, the ocean circulation is quite amazing, actually. So what are we? We're in May right now. So back in, I think it was January and February, we had another mini heat wave here on the West Coast. It didn't get anything near as extreme as 2011, but it was still pretty hectic. And that's the thing. That's the other thing that the community don't really realize what's going on. They might go for a swim and think, oh, like this is, it's still kind of cool, but like it's a bit warmer than normal. Whereas in reality, it could be a few degrees warmer than normal, which is a huge difference for temperate reef communities. So no, they happen completely separate. And in fact, the marine heat waves generally happen, they're quite prolonged events. So for example, 2011, it happened over 10 weeks where water temperatures were up to 5 degrees warmer than normal. So that's massive. 5 degrees doesn't sound much to people, but that is huge for marine communities, and it's too much for them to deal with, really.
Yeah. And so there's the increase in temperature. And on a scientific level, if you can put it into layman's terms, like what is it about the heat that harms the kelp?
Basically, it affects their metabolism. It affects how they grow. Okay. And like any organism has this optimal range, this optimal temperature that they like. So you could kind of look at corals as the opposite. So they like it warmer to a certain degree, but they still have that range which they function the best in. Kelps are exactly the same. They just prefer that cool water range instead.
And I can also imagine that if they are a plant that's underwater and they're not they must get their oxygen from the ocean. But another part of climate change is the acidification of the ocean. And so that must also be one of the key stresses that's being placed on them.
Yeah, that is an interesting one. Acidification, it's not as big a threat in Australia, in our temperate reefs anyway. The threat's just not there for them yet. It's more in our warmer environments that we're kind of starting to see the impacts of that come into play. So that is, I guess, lucky in one sense. We're not there yet with our temperate reefs. It's definitely the temperature that's impacting them and threatening them the most.
Yeah. Oh, poor little kelp forests.
I know.
Do you think that these impacts, you said that the 2011 event really, you haven't seen much bounce back for the kelps specifically. Do you think that was just a freak one-off event and that perhaps in the future there will be some, there'll be some way that they'll be able to bounce back? Or what do you think that's just it, that's done?
No, I don't think that's done. I definitely think there are options for them bouncing back, but they need a hand. And that is what some colleagues of mine at the University of Western Australia are working on at the moment. They call it green gravel. It's basically they're trying to develop these restoration techniques for kelp forests. And there's obviously that element of, all right, how do we effectively seed new regions? But then there's the element of where should we be restoring? And that's what's really important, because if we just went out to the exact same places where we knew there were kelp forests that all died because of the last heating event, then maybe that's not really the best place to go and try and restore, given that we know that's an area vulnerable to temperature changes in the first place. So there's this whole other really new side to research where we're basically trying to see if there's stretches along the coast which may present an area of refuge from thermal changes. So like I kind of mentioned, the ocean circulation is complex, and even if you just go to one town, you can kind of find pockets of warmer and pockets of cooler water at really localized scales. So the next big thing for kelp forest restoration anyway is really trying to identify these places that could represent refugia or a place less vulnerable to future temperature changes. And then those are the places that we should target for restoration, because that's where they have the best shot at surviving.
And is there any discussion about bringing less temperate species into the temperate, kind of like as a way of like preparing for the warming waters, like an adaptation method?
So kind of. So not necessarily less temperate, because it's not that clear-cut line. It's not like you go 10 metres this way and we're in a tropical coral reef and from here down is kelp. It is that transition that right. we get between tropical and temperate. So there are regions like Kalbarri on the west coast and Coffs Harbour on the east coast, which we do see that mix of tropical and temperate species already. But really interesting what you said about that adaptation, because yes, exactly. We are, that is the other, another element to it, is we get variation in vulnerability when you're looking at kelp forests. So for example, part of my PhD research was up in around the Kalbarri region, a region where we lost 100% of our kelp forests because of the marine heat wave. And yeah, a decade later, doing all these surveys, doing all these experiments, and there was still no kelp there. And then I was actually chatting with some of the local fishermen in the town one night, and they told me, oh, we pull up kelp in our cray pots all the time. I kind of laughed it off. It's like, no, you don't. Like, you're pulling up something else. It's not kelp. There's no kelp here. Trust me, I've looked. I'm like, no, I think it's kelp. And I got them to send me a photo next time they pulled it up, and lo and behold, it was bloody kelp. And
was it the golden kelp, the one?
It was the golden kelp. And I was like, where is that? And it took a bit of convincing, but we got the GPS coordinates off them in the end. And it was actually further north than we were surveying, which was weird in itself. And we found they were small, but we found a few healthy, functioning kelp forests.
Wow.
And this is in a region where everything else, all of our other survey sites, there was 100% loss. And so obviously the first questions that I wanted to ask were, could this represent a resilient population? Could these kelps have survived the heat wave when nothing else did? And then the question would be why? So we do find populations like this that are particularly resilient, or they can handle the temperature changes a little bit better than all the other kelp forests. And that's the other element of restoration, is how do we firstly identify why they're more resilient, and then how do we harness that resilience and kind of add it into our restoration efforts to, again, give those kelp forests the absolute best chance of survival.
Gosh, that's amazing. I love when people chance come across some old fisherman who's like, they just know. They're just on
the
ocean.
They just know. I know. 24/7. Amazing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I want to go back a few steps and ask two questions. I'll start with this one. When you say you get 100% loss of kelp forests, What does that actually look like? Mm. We talk a lot about coral bleaching and you kind of have this image of white reef, but with a kelp forest, what actually happens? Does it kind of break away and wash up on the shore, or does it just, what happens?
Yeah, so when the kelps are too thermally stressed, they will detach from the substrate, so detach from the rock, and then they will eventually die. And so we definitely see some of it washing up on shore, but something that's super interesting, especially in the carbon space, is that we think a lot of our kelp and even our seaweed biomass is getting transported offshore and into the deep ocean. But basically it does disappear and decompose in some way. And then what it looks like is these reefs, they go from being, it would be like if you went to a forest and just cut down all the trees. It goes from being these beautiful, structurally complex habitat to just this fluffy, we call it turfing algae. And it's just like, it is the sticky, slimy stuff that everyone thinks of when you say algae. It's the gross, structurally really simple, fluffy stuff that covers the rock. It goes from being quite complex and beautiful to just very simple and, yeah, providing not much at all to the ecosystem.
So you've already mentioned that the kelp forests provide, they obviously do a great job of absorbing carbon and helping the ocean fight against climate change. It provides habitat for creatures. Mm-hmm. Is it a source of food for anyone?
It is, and that's another interesting element that's changing with climate change as well. So, seaweeds are a source of food. A lot of fish and invertebrates, so snails and things like that, consume kelps and consume seaweeds. And that's another thing that we saw change after the heat wave in 2011 on the West Coast. So what happens, as you can imagine, there's quite a fine balance in an ecosystem between how much production there is, so how much the seaweeds are growing, and then how much they're getting eaten. So in order for a seaweed forest to survive, that production has to outweigh consumption. And in a healthy temperate ecosystem, it does. There's not a huge amount of kelps and of seaweeds that's consumed by organisms living around it, or there's enough that it's kept in balance. But what happened after the heat wave is we saw a heap of tropical fish moving south into these kelp forests. So these are fish species that we don't normally find in the region. And these guys, in a coral reef, in tropical environments, they play a really important role of consuming seaweeds to such a high level that it allows space for corals to grow. So that's their role in the ecosystem, to keep seaweed at a low level for the corals. So you can imagine as they moved into these seaweed-dominated places, into these temperate ecosystems where there's seaweed everywhere, they absolutely went to town. Mm. And they consumed seaweeds at such high rates that this balance was shifted and it tipped it over the edge. So that was what was unique about our heat wave here on the West Coast, is that there was that direct impact of temperature, which was a massive impact and we think killed off a large majority of our kelp forests. But then these tropical fish came in, and any ones that did survive, they ate them. So there was like, it was this double whammy of an impact. And that consumption was particularly devastating on the West.
And have those tropical fish stuck around?
So it's interesting, in some places they have. So we, after the heat wave, we saw a real big pulse in their numbers. There was an influx of tropical fish. It was pretty insane. And we've seen them, those numbers have returned back to near marine heat wave levels. So they're still around in the system, but they're not at that super high, super devastating level that they were before.
What about sea urchins? I've also heard a lot about sea urchins being quite impactful.
Yeah, so that's another herbivore that is, that interaction is changing with climate change again. So, and this is a really interesting one, because we also get sea urchins on the West Coast, but for some reason they are not having an impact in the system over here. We have no idea why. We see them at really high levels, kind of similar to the East Coast, but for some reason the urchins are just chilling out on the West Coast. It's weird. But on the East Coast, changing sea temperatures, we're seeing huge pulses in the urchin population. So they're massively increasing in numbers, and they're moving further and further south. So as the ocean becomes warmer in places like Victoria and Tassie, the urchins are moving into these environments, into places that where they weren't found before. And urchins love to have a feed on kelps. So when they move into these areas where kelps are really abundant, they just go to town. And when they, again, going back to that balance, when you shift the balance, when there's too much consumption in a system that the production of our kelp forests can't sustain, that's where you see the loss being driven by urchins. And it creates what we call these urchin barrens, which are pretty devastating to look at. It's just a place where there used to be all this beautiful kelp, and now it's just rocky and again, structurally very simple and not providing much to the ecosystem.
What eats urchins?
Lobsters. Lobsters eat urchins. So that was another mechanism that kind of aided their population increases in places like Tassie, when the lobsters were overfished. And so if you're thinking of that food chain, if you take one guy out of the food chain, whatever it eats explodes, and that's another contributor. So it's, a bit of climate change, but then a bit of kind of direct human causes in there as well.
Yeah. Oh, great.
We're doing
a good job, aren't we? We're just affecting the climate, affecting the biodiversity, the levels.
Yeah, coming at it from all angles.
It doesn't give it much of a chance to just survive. So the Great Southern Reef, to me, it kind of sounds like at the moment it's doing pretty well, and that's why you want to really put the spotlight on it and try and preserve it. In a perfect world, how could you preserve the Great Southern Reef?
Yeah, you can definitely say majority of it is doing pretty well. I think if you just look at the South Coast, that is definitely where it's the most pristine. It's the most beautiful places to dive down there. But in saying that, because it is so large, there are still places that are being really impacted. So the East and the West Coast in particular, they are, we're seeing the impacts there first. In an ideal world, well, I'm a really strong believer of people protect what they love and they love what they understand. And it's that understanding, that component that we're really trying to target with all of our campaigns related to the Great Southern Reef. We think that if we can get people just understanding what their local marine environments hold and understanding the importance of them, that'll just translate into them caring about it. And if you don't know something exists, of course you can't care about it. So really that's step one for us, is trying to raise the public profile of the Great Southern Reef to really drive that sense of stewardship that people feel towards protecting their local regions. And I think that itself is a pretty powerful thing, is when people start caring about something and then they feel passionately towards protecting it, that kind of translates up the food chain and into bigger and better things. And those bigger and better things are really about protection at state and at federal level. So, for example, we in Western Australia, on the south coast of WA, we don't have a single marine park. There is not a single place that our state government monitors or manages along the south coast. Not a single one. And WA is massive as well. That's a huge stretch of absolutely beautiful coastline that we do not look at. And really that blows my mind, is how can we have these epic ecosystems that we're not even putting any effort into monitoring to even realize what is impacting them at the moment. So that's a huge gap that's missing for me at the moment. I think South Australia and Victoria and Tassie are to a lesser extent. They do have some regions that are monitored. But still, if you took a map of Australia and look at the tropical versus the temperate environments that we're currently managing, it will blow your mind, and how much effort and resources we're putting into tropical versus temperate, when really these ecosystems warrant the same. They are just as amazing as each other. They contribute just as much. In fact, there are stats that says the Great Southern Reef contributes significantly more. And it blows my mind how we're not, we're taking so much from this ecosystem and we're not putting back into it. This relationship doesn't match up.
Yeah. Do you think it's because it's kind of less glamorous because it's kind of cold and wild and woolly?
I think so. It is wild and woolly, that's for sure. It's yeah, field work is, it's challenging and it's unforgiving, absolutely. But maybe that's why these ecosystems are thriving in some regions. Maybe like the less human pressures that we're putting on them is actually a good thing.
But that's yeah, just tourism. I feel like there's been a lot mm-hmm. of pressures, proposed pressures, at least like with offshore oil rigs and absolutely. Seismic testing. Like mm-hmm. the fact that not many people go there is like a double-edged sword, because then a lot of big industrial stuff kind of just gets swept under the rug and happens, and you wouldn't even really know. Like the
yeah, they are certainly trying, that's for sure. It's yeah, the oil and gas drilling is the big one, particularly oil. That's who, or some big international companies have been trying to get into regions of the Bight and across the South Coast for quite a while. Mm. It is a good news story that the community uproar around that has been enough to turn them away. I'm sure that is also comprised of economic components that's turned them away as well, but definitely that community passion to kind of stand behind these environments goes a long way. I mean, it shows the power of the people, and I think it's that energy that we want to harness, not just across the Bight or like regions of South Australia, but there are communities all along the southern coast and the west and the east coast who do feel just as passionate about their local environments, and it's that passion, that energy that we want to harness and bring them all together as this collective community, because really we are all working towards protecting the same entity, the same interconnected system, and that's what people don't realize. So I think there's something that is potentially really powerful once we kind of do get the word out and we do get people realizing that they're all working towards the same thing and creating that community.
It sounds like marine parks, putting in a few more marine parks in those like more west coast sections would be like the main goal. Is that right?
Yeah, step one, I think marine parks aren't going to solve all our problems. Like climate change is the big issue. Without the million steps and the things that need to happen at federal government level to address that, these ecosystems, the Great Southern Reef is going to be in trouble in the future. But marine parks and just establishing that monitoring can be super powerful. Again, if we don't know that changes are happening in these ecosystems, then we can't care about it, we can't address them, and yeah, they'll just get swept under the rug. Yeah. So really figuring out, getting a monitoring program in place is a starting point that is really essential.
And what other things can listeners, but then also what other things need to happen to try and help the kelp forests survive these big changes?
I still think that in general, raising the profile of the Great Southern Reef is something that can be really powerful as well. Like I kind of said, people won't care about something that they don't know exists. So I think that, getting out there and just making, telling people about this amazing ecosystem that is right on their doorstep. So I think the stat is 70% of Australians live within 50K of the Great Southern Reef.
Wow.
Most of us live near the Great Southern Reef. If we all went for a swim in the ocean, we would see the Great Southern Reef. And people don't know that. They can't associate their local environment with something bigger. So I think trying to help people make that connection can be really powerful. I'm also a really strong believer that there are always certain people that only you can reach and only you can talk about these kinds of things with. So I know climate change, it can be a pretty difficult topic to chat about, but everyone has at least one other person that only they can reach. So maybe it's your grandma who is really set in her ways, who thinks climate change is not real, we are not impacting the environment, but maybe it takes you as her granddaughter to come to her and to explain like what you are seeing in your local environment firsthand. And maybe that's what it takes to kind of change her mind on something. I'm a really strong believer that if we all seek out those people and target those people who only we can reach and only we can help make them aware and contribute to changing their mind, then I think that has the potential to be really impactful. And then we're also trying to kind of aid these discussions and aid this education side of things as well. So we have been working really hard on our socials and putting up this beautiful content that people can show their friends and show their colleagues. And we find that when we give people these really visual things that they can relate a lot more and get excited a lot easier.
Yeah.
And then we're also taking this one step further where we've just finished a project funded by National Geographic where we created this suite of educational resources for teachers to take into their classrooms. So these are literal lesson plans that align with the Australian National Curriculum that were developed by a teacher in our team, all based along about the Great Southern Reef, that a teacher can pick up, maybe adapt a little bit to whatever they're teaching at that moment, but take straight into their classroom. And they have these amazing visuals, these amazing quizzes and activities. Everything is set out for you and super easy to make small changes to as well. But basically, we're trying to make it easier for people to talk about the Great Southern Reef and easier for people to teach about the Great Southern Reef as well. And these are all on our socials, on our website. GreatSouthernReef.com is where you can pretty much find links to anything you need.
Awesome. I started following the Instagram account last night. It's so good. I'm so glad you brought that up because I was going to say that Instagram is great and like using those platforms that the majority of our population are on anyway. Mm-hmm. It's like visually it's really enticing and yeah, it's
that's
great.
That's the goal.
Yeah. So I'll put all of those links and everything into this episode so people can find them. I just wanted to say that the way that you kind of balance, I mean, it's not so much a question as just like just an observation that it's really lovely seeing how much you balance your really academic research with science communication.
And oh, thank you.
It's so great to see because it is really difficult to kind of translate that research, that really science heavy stuff into something that's more palpable and like easy to kind of digest for everyone.
Yeah, and scientists are shocking at it. We are useless, and I mean, of course we are. We're trained to use our data and to use plots as the way that we can prove or disprove a scientific question we're asking. Whereas, like you mentioned, it's 21st century. It's visual. It's how do we get the how do we get the audience engaged in like a few seconds and keep them engaged, and plots and data do not do that. And that's definitely an approach that the Great Southern Reef Project is trying to take is this modern, visually engaging, aesthetically pleasing approach. because scientists are useless.
No, they're useful for just some things, not all of the things.
No.
my final question in the last 2 minutes. You finished your PhD. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
An absolute momentous feeling. What's next for you and your research?
Yeah, you know, that's a good question.
Are you taking a break?
I'm not taking a break. I'm the opposite of taking a break. I'm going full ball into the Great Southern Reef Project. We're trying to, so far it's been this kind of collective group. All of us are spread across Australia and none of us work on this full time. So we're a group of volunteers, all have our own full time jobs. So it's been this kind of side project for us. And I'm just wrapping up my PhD. I've decided I want to put some like solid effort into this. I think the potential of this project is huge and I'm super passionate about it. So I'm definitely going to be focusing on pumping out a few projects with that. But it is interesting because I like to say I'm keeping my options open. I'm being flexible. And I saw this really interesting, not a quote, but this guy said, some people look for a job, some people look for a career, and others look for a calling. And that's definitely what I'm trying to find. I'm trying to find what is my calling and what is the area that I can contribute to that's going to have the most impact and contribute to really meaningful change. And I think that's going to be, as I'm absolutely going to be Great Southern Reef related, but what actual path we go down, we're still trying to figure it out.
Watch this space.
Watch this space, but also contribute if, we're always on the hunt for opportunities and for ways to kind of, drive this project and get the ball rolling.
Yeah. Well, I guess the biggest thing listeners can do is tune in and support on the social media and all the
accounts. That's definitely the immediate thing to do is, follow our work. And that is where we not only kind of promote the projects that we're working on, but that's also where we kind of post for help when there's something that the community could help us with back, that's the avenues that we'll be kind of targeting.
That was Sarah Bell. You can keep up to date with all her amazing research on Instagram at Sarah Bell and learn more about the Great Southern Reef Project at The Great Southern Reef. And a reminder to go in the running to win one of two incredible prize packs from Spooked Kook Surfboards, Camp Cove Swim, and For Purpose Recycling. All you have to do is leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts and follow all four Instagram accounts. I'll choose a winner at random by the end of season two. Thanks so much for tuning in. You can hit me up on the pod's Instagram or via our website. And I'll catch you next episode.